We're holding on page 8 in Eirvin, 3 lines from the bottom, middle of Oisvar. We're in the middle of quoting a bunch of statements from Rav Yumi ben Elazar in matters of Agadta. So the last one actually was about Gehenim, and then we got into a whole discussion about that. So now the Gemara continues in that vein with another teaching of his on the subject. Gehenim has 3 openings. Echad b'midbar, one in the desert, the echad b'yom, and one in the sea, the echad b'Yerushalayim, and one in Yerushalayim. So what's the significance of that? There are different explanations. Marsha explains, to start with, that the world is basically divided into 3 parts. You have the desert, you have the sea, and you have the inhabited lands. So therefore, corresponding to each of those, in each of those places, if a person is in those places, if a person is there and acts wrongly, then he can wind up in Gehenna, and therefore symbolizing that there's an entrance to Gehenna over there. There's different other points as well. The Maharal makes a point that it corresponds to 3 different ways that a person might deny things, basic ideas of Yiddishkeit. He might deny Hashem's Hashgacha over the world, or that he speaks to the Nevi'im, or Schar Va'onesh. Corresponding to those, there's a different opening in each place. Rabbi Yaakov of Lissa, one of famous Achron who wrote the Sefer Derech HaChayim on Halacha and a number of other Sfarim. He explains the vote is, he says the desert represents the Bali Machlokas, like Korach in the desert. The sea represents people who have the ability to give toichacha to others, and instead they run away from it, like Yonah running away and ending up in the ocean over there in the sea. And Yerushalayim represents gasus haruach, which the Nevi'im, a number of the Nevi'im, talk about that there was a problem with Bali Gaiva and Yerushalayim. So therefore those represent 3 different ways that a person might wind up in Gehenna. Eon Yaakov, by the way, points out, on the other hand, you know, we learned yesterday we said that the Goyish Rishoyim afiyal pischa shal Gehenim enum choizrim, as opposed to the Jewish Rishoyim do. Therefore, it's good that there are multiple openings to Gehenim. That way, they instead of have them all having to go in front of one of them, and only then do they do tshuva, like this, they have multiple opportunities to do tshuva. Anyway, so there are 3 there are 3 of them. By Midbar Dichtiv, we know there's an opening in the Midbar because it says by Korach, by Yerushalayim, B'chol Asher Lahem Chayim Sho'ela, they and everything of theirs went down alive into the grave. And then Sho'el. Now Sho'el on one level means the grave, but the Gemara is going to explain soon that it's actually a name for Gehenna. So they went down to Gehenna. So we see therefore that there's an entrance to Gehenna in the desert. In fact, Rashi brings on the pasuk from a Gemara in Nedarim that Moshe asks when Moshe says in Bria Yivra Hashem, it means that he's saying if Hashem already created a mouth of Gehenna around here, then good. And if not, then Hashem should bring the mouth over here so that it'll be available. So there was one there. By Yom Dichtiv, we see that there's one in the sea, because Yonah, when he was inside the fish, he says, "Mi beten she'ol shivati, I cried out to Hashem from the belly of she'ol," where again she'ol means Gehenim, "shamata koli, and you heard my voice." So we see now in a simple sense, of course, it means, Marsha says, that it means that he's calling himself being in the belly of the fish as tantamount to being in the grave or in Gehenim. But still, the fact that he's using the word sha'ol means he must have been at the entrance of Gehenna at the time. And in fact, there are midrashim that talk about that while he was inside the fish over there, he got a whole tour over there. He got a tour of Gan Eden and Gehenna and the foundations of this mikdash and so on and so forth. And then seal of Yosem from afar. So in that case, at one point, they're passing by Gehenna, and that's when he said this passage. And Yerushalayim, where we see there's an opening for Gehenna and Yerushalayim, Dichtiv, as the passage says, Hashem says, Asher Loi B'Tzion, Hashem has a fire in Tzion, B'Tanu Loi B'Yerushalayim, and he has an oven in Yerushalayim. So what does that mean? B'Tanu Dvei Rabbi Shmuel, Asher Loi B'Tzion, when it says he has a fire in Tzion, Zu Gehenna, that means Gehenna itself, B'Tanu Loi B'Yerushalayim, Zu Pisco Shor Gehenna, and the oven in Yerushalayim refers to the entrance of Gehenna. So Marsha points out Now, the entrance to Gehenim, fine, can be in Yerushalayim. Gehenim itself, the Gemara mentions in other places, in Pesachim and in Tainus, is thousands of times larger than the world. So how could it possibly fit in Yerushalayim? So, okay, Ben Yehoyada says that's not such a question. The fact is we're talking about ruchniistic realities, so they're not necessarily bounded by physical space. But anyway, Marsha says what it means is, look, okay, the simple meaning of the Pasuk, if you look at the context of the Pasuk, this is talking about how Sanhedrin's army that was camped outside Yerushalayim is going to be burnt up and destroyed, as we learned briefly about it in Shabbos. But the fact that the Pasuk says the double expression, Ur Loi B'tzi and the Tanu Loi B'Yerushalayim, implies, therefore, that at least the opening to Gehenim, even if not Gehenim itself, is in Yerushalayim. So the Gemara asks the two Lekka, so you're telling me there's no other openings into Gehenim? V'ha'amr of Muria and Amr of Yishuv and Levi, V'amr of Tana, Rava Bamori, or Rava Bamurian, the Giveir of Yechim and Zakai. So one version is that a Murian is saying it in the name of Yishuv and Levi. Another version pushes it back a couple hundred years and says that Rava Bamurian is teaching a Braisa that was originally taught in the Yeshiva of Rabbi Yechim and Zakai. It was like 250 years before Rabbi Yishuv and Levi. Anyway, so he says, Beis Tmorim Yesh B'Gei Ben Hinoim, there are two palm trees in Gei Ben Hinoim, which is a deep valley near Yerushalayim. If you stand outside Shal Yafo, you have this very deep valley looking across to where the windmill is and whatever, and that deep valley is called Gei Ben Hinoim. Back in the day, Psukim mentioned that people worshipped Moloch over there and brought their children as korbanos. So anyway, so there are two palm trees over there. Va'ola Oshan Remenehem, smoke comes up from between the palm trees. Vizuhi Shishaninu, those palm trees are what are referred to in a Mishnah in Sukkah when it says Sine Har HaBarzok Sheiris. It talks about there about what's kosher for a lulav. So it says Sine, which is a type of palm tree. The palm trees that grow in Har HaBarzel on the mountain of iron, Kshedus, the lulavim of those, from those trees are kosher to use for the mitzvah of lulav. Meaning, the Gemara explains, even though the leaves on them are very stunted, and the lower leaves barely just reach the tips of them just barely reach the bottoms of the leaves above them, unlike with a regular lulav where you have the leaves are thick along the shedra, here you have the shedra is just barely covered with leaves, nevertheless they're kosher. So those stunted lulavim come from these two palm trees that we're talking about. The Zuhi Pisosho Gehenim, that place where the smoke is coming out, is the entrance of Gehenim. So we see there's a fourth entrance. So the Gemara says, okay, Duma Hainu to Yerushalayim. Maybe when we say there's an entrance in Yerushalayim, we mean in Gei Ben Hinnom, which is right outside Yerushalayim. Maybe it doesn't have to be actually within the walls of Yerushalayim. Tosfos brings, but doesn't like, after all, Tosfos points out that the Gei Ben Hinnom is described in Pesukim in Yehoshua when it describes the border between the territories of Yehuda and Binyamin. It mentions Gei Ben Hinnom over there right near Yerushalayim. Tosfos brings a Girsa also and doesn't like it, that the Gemara says maybe it's the one in the Midbar. But Tosfos doesn't like that, because why would we call an area right outside Yerushalayim, why would we call that the Midbar? Anyway, Marashah says the symbolism of it is, what's one thing that can lead a person to Gehenim is where he's too much into the sweetness and the tanugim of this world. So therefore, representing that, you have two palm trees and smoke coming out from between them. The smoke of Gehenim, we're saying, because the palm trees bear sweet fruit, sweet dates, and if a person is too much into that kind of taiva, it can lead him in the wrong direction. There's also a symbolic explanation about it from the Maharal, but I'm not sure I remember all of it. He talks about something, the Chlal, in many places in his Sfarim, he talks about two represents the concept of Machloikas. We know on the second day of Ma'is Bereshis is when the concept of Machloikas is created by Yabdel Kim, Ben Amayim, or Ben Amayim. So therefore, two palm trees particularly represents the kind of machlokas and the crack in the ground between them that smoke pours out of it, represents the fire and that can be brought about by machlokas and wine then makes a person wind up in Gehenim. So the Gemara continues, and in this vein, since we're talking about Gehenim, Amr Abishur Ben Levi, Zion Shemus Yeshlo the Gehenim. Gehenim actually has seven names. The Evohain, Sheol, Va'avadon, Ube'er Shachas, Ubur Shoin, the Tita Yovin, the Tsalmoves, the Eretz Tachtis. So translating them literally, Sheol means the underworld, like Avada means the place of going lost. Be'er Shachas means the pit of destruction. Bor Shoin or Be'er is a well, literally, so the well of destruction. Bor Shoin means the pit of noise. The Tita Yobin, the slimy mud, with some of us, the shadow of death, the Eretz Tachtis, and the lower land or the lower world. And the Gemara is going to show Psukim for each one of them where we see that Gehenim bears those names. What's the symbolism of Gehenim having seven names? So Akosev over here brings a long piece from the Ramban that talks about what it means that there are actually seven levels of Gehenim, and it goes on and describes based on earlier Sforim and based on earlier Midrashim of what's going on in each one of those seven levels, different types of Rishoyim are judged in each one. And then he goes on eventually, the Ramban goes on to explain from the Ramban. You have to ask. I mean, we seem to be talking about that in other places, the Gemara talks about here, the Gemara is saying that there are physical openings to Gehenim here and there in the world. We even have a halacha that Sinei HaRabazal that has to do with that. In other places, the Gemara talks about the size of Gehenim and so on and so forth. So it's hard to say that it's a purely ruchniistic thing. But on the other hand, then how does a ruchniistic neshama get affected by a gashmi? Gehenim. And he gives a very long discussion over here, and the gist of it is that there are different levels within Gashmius itself, and Hashem, who created all these things, made it that there's a certain type of Gashmius that can affect the Ruchnius of the Neshama, and where we can speak of the Neshama being burnt and cleansed and whatever in these places. Anyway, Marsha points out another point is that we learned at the end of Shabbos there are seven basic ways that we can characterize a person's midos. We talked about over there Mazel Yoim and Mazel Shemazel Yoim, where there are 7 days of the week. Mazel Shah, where there are seven planets that have an influence in the world. So in general, a person's midos, and we know Alpi Kabbalah, of course, you have the seven midos from Chesed through Malchus. So different people act in different ways based on them, and therefore corresponding to that, there have to be seven types of punishment in the world, and therefore seven types of Gehenna. Depending each one appropriate to the type of aveda the person did. One of the Mephoshim, I think it might be Ben Yehoyada, points out another point as well, that we know the Goyim have seven mitzvahs. We have 613 mitzvahs. We said yesterday, Gehenim is really the place more for the Goyim. Jews, we said, for the most part, don't stay very long in there because Avraham Avinu schleps them out. So therefore, corresponding to that, there are seven levels of Gehenim, which is more appropriate for them where they don't keep their seven mitzvahs. Anyway. The Rambam, by the way, points out in Hilchos Tshuva when he discusses the whole concept of Gan Eden and Gehenim over there, he says, Bechlal, the idea is that the Gehenim refers to a place of ultimate destruction. Therefore, he says, you find the Psukim, you find these various names over here, and the names that Chazal give Gehenim all represent it's a place, for example, Avada, in the place of ultimate being lost. And other such things like that, because that's what it is. The Maharal makes a similar point in a number of places in his Sfarim. He says Gehenim is basically the ultimate nullity. It's the ultimate nothingness. So that's why it's called by these names representing like there's nothing there. It's a place of ultimate Ra, so to speak, and Ra has no Metzius of its own. Anyway, so where do we have Pesukim? So Sheol Dichtiv, we have the pasuk from Yonah that we quoted before. Mibetin Sheol Shivati Shamata Koli. That he says, I cried out from the belly of Sheol, and you heard my voice. So on one level it means he's comparing his experience over there inside the fish to being in Gehenna, but on another level we're saying that he was given a tour that included the area that included one of the openings to Gehenna that's in the sea. Next. Avadim d'chtiv, you have a pasuk, ha'yisupa b'kever chastecha, can your chesed be told over when a person is in the grave? And munoscha ba'avadim, can your truth be told when a person is in avadim? So if kever means the actual physical grave, then avadim means where the neshama goes after that if it was undeserving, and therefore it winds up in, and therefore that's another name for Gehenna. Marsha, by the way, points out there are places in Psukim where the word Sheol can easily mean the grave. For example, when we have the pasuk by Korach and his people, that by Yerduhem, Chol Hashem Chaim Sheolah, you can equally explain over there that Sheol there means the grave. But when you come to the pasuk from Yonah, then it's more. Then it's the Tosfos points out the same thing. For example, that when you have the pasuk. Yeah, we're going to talk about Be'er Shachas in a minute. So you have also a pasuk Va'ata Elikim Tode Den Le'er Shachas. There also you can understand that it just means the grave. So the Gemara is trying to look for psukim where we see unequivocally that it has to mean something beyond the grave, namely Gehenna. So Be'er Shachas Tichtiv Kilo Sazev Nafshi L'Sheol. David says you won't abandon my neshama to Sheol. Lo Sitin Chasidcha L'Res Shachas. You won't allow your chasid, meaning myself, to see Shachas. So we see that Gehenna is called Be'er Shachas. And here's where Tosfos says that you can't say from Va'ata Elikim Chodidim Le'er Shachas, because that couldn't just mean they're going to end up in an early grave, as we have. The Gemara tells us that it refers to Doeg and Achitofel, who died, and Bilam, who died at ages 33 and 34. So therefore, but once we have the word loisaz of nafshi l'sheol, even if you're going to say in that pasuk sheol means the grave, then shochas must mean something beyond that, namely Gehen. Next, ubo shorin betita yovin. The next two, where do we see that Gehenim is called that? Dichtiv, another pasuk in Tehillim, vayaleinim ubo shorin. Hashem brought me up from ubo shorin betita yovin, from the pit of noise. Mitita Yovin from the slimy mud, the sticky mud. So we see again, David is thanking Hashem not for taking him out of the physical grave, because Tchias HaNesim is only going to happen when Mashiach comes, but that Hashem took him out from having to experience Gehenna. Next, Salmoves, Tichtiv, Yoshvei Choshech Salmoves. The pasuk says the people who are living in darkness and in Salmoves, in the shadow of darkness. Now, on the other hand, there are Tosfos points out that, I mean, that really doesn't fit as a description of Gehenna. That pasuk Yoshvei Choshech Salmoves is talking about people who are in jail. Asira Oni Uvarzel, that they're bound up in misery and in iron, and they're among the Abash of Tzuchim Lahodus. So rather, Tosfos prefers a different Girsa, that the Gemara wants to quote a pasuk from Eov, where Eov is saying that before I go, I want to at least be vindicated. He says, before I go and I never return, to the land of darkness and some of us. So that would make it more clear that he's talking about before I die and my neshama goes to Gehenna, I want to be vindicated that I was speaking correctly here. So that shows that some of us refers to Gehenna. By the way, what about, why don't we mention Choshech over here? Because Anaf Yosef points out that Choshech is not really a name of Gehenim so much, it's more of a description of it. It's a place of darkness, therefore it's called Choshech. But some of us is more an actual name of it. Next, the Eretz Tachtis Gemarahu, that Gehenim is called Eretz Tachtis, that we don't have a clear passage for, that we only have the Kabbalah. Now, Tosfos points out there is actually a pasuk in Yechezkel. There's a section over there in Yechezkel where he's talking about how all the goyim who come and fight by Melchamas Gog and Magog, how they're all going to wind up dead and in the grave, and then he goes on to say that Paro is going to see them and he's going to feel better for all the losses that he suffered at different times, and there it mentions the words Eretz Tachtis. So Tosfos rather says maybe the Girsa in the Gemara, instead of Eretz Tachtis, should be Eretz Chitis, the land of terror. And that you don't have. You have in the Psukim over there, it mentions about these various Goyish armies, Asher Nosno Chitisam, the Eretz Chaim, that they terrorized the land of the living, meaning the Jews in Eretz Yisrael, but it never actually calls Gehenna over there Eretz Chitis, so that would be the Kabbalah, that it would be called that. On the other hand, Marsha says that maybe the Gemara doesn't mean that the name Eretz Tachtis is not found in Psukim. It is, but how do we know that that's the lowest level of Gehenna? The Gemara is listing them, the Pashtos, in order from highest to lowest. How would we know that Eretz Tachtis is the lowest? That we would know only the Kabbalah. Okay, so those are the seven names representing the seven levels of Gehenna. So then the Gemara asks the two lecha. So you're telling me there's no more than those seven names? And by the way, there was another point that that one of the Mephoshim points out that this Gemara in Sukkah that tells us that the Yetzirah has seven names, also represented seven different ways that he tries to entrap a person. Therefore, corresponding to that, again, there are seven levels of Gehenna. So the Gemara asks the two lekas, so you're telling me there are no more, Rohika Gehenna. What about the actual name Gehenna itself? And the Gemara answers, that's not a real name of Gehenna. Geisha Mukuk Gehenna. It means, first of all, it's a valley as deep as the valley of Gehinnom, that deep valley near Yerushalayim. Which Marsha points out. Now, the actual name of the valley itself is Geh Ben Hinnom, but then after that, when the Pesukim are describing the borders over there, it mentions afterwards, it says the border comes to a certain hill that's next to Geh Ben Hinnom, and then it says the Yorad Geh Hinnom, then the border goes downward to Gehinnom. So that also serves as a drasha that people go down into Gehinnom. So therefore, we see from that pasuk that Gehinnom is an actual name of the place. So the one answer is okay. So it means again that Gehinnom is as deep as that valley. And second of all, Shako Yodinba al Iske Chinam. And number two, also because people go into Gehinnom, many people go into Gehinnom because of matters of Chinam. Now, the Gemara tells us in Yuma that in Parshas Bahaloiskel, when Jewish people are complaining, we remember the fish that we ate in Mitzrayim Chinam for free. It means, among other things, they were complaining about that now they're also in Arayas. And in fact, now Shor explains that there's a reason why the word Chinam, free, can be associated with Arayas. You get married, you have to provide money. You have to provide a nadan to the chosin has to provide money to that the Kala's father should be willing to marry her off to him. But when you're marrying your relative, you don't need that. So in a certain sense, marrying your relative is free. So therefore, and the Jewish people are complaining that they can't do that anymore. So therefore, Arayas can be called Chinam, and therefore, so as the Gemara often does, we douse in a hey and a ches as being equivalent. So therefore, Gei Chinam can be reinterpreted as Gei Chinam, meaning the valley that people go into because of the Aveira of Chinam, meaning Arayas. So it's not a real name. It's just describing why people wind up there. Okay, the Gemara asks, well, Ika Tofseh, what about you have another name of Gehenim that's called an apostate Tofseh? Dichtiv, as apostate in Yeshaya says, Ki Oruch Me'esmul Tofseh. Tofseh has been prepared as of yesterday, and the Gemara in Nedarim explains that it means that Gehenim was created, and also in Psachim discusses that it means that Gehenim was created on the second day of Ma'aseh Bereishis. Because Esmul means a day that has a yesterday but doesn't have a 2 days ago. The Monday of Ma'aseh Bereishis had a yesterday. The day before is Yom Rishon of Ma'aseh Bereishis. 2 days before, it didn't exist. Hashem hadn't started creating the world yet, and time didn't exist yet. So therefore, that indicates that it was created on the second day. Actually, Gemara in Pesachim discusses that it brings over there a braisa that Gehenim is one of the things created before the world was created. Shivat Barim Nivru, Kodim Shinivra Olam. And so the Gemara explains over there the actual space of Gehenim was created Kodim Shinivra Olam, and the fire of it was created on the second day of Ma'aseh Bereishis. It represents, among other things, the idea that, you have Kodim Shinivra Olam, you have Olam HaTorihu, and Shviras HaKelim, and all that. And then afterwards, on the second day, Ma'aseh Bereishis, again, is when Hashem separated the Mayim Oyonim and Mayim Tachtonim, and brought, and that was an aspect of Gvura, and that brought Machloikas, and went everyone to the world. So that represents the fire of Gehenim being kindled. So it's both Kodim Shinivra Olam and on the second day. Mashar points out in Nedarim another way of looking at it, as it means before Hashem, means that Gehenim was created before the dry land came into existence. Dry land is only on the third day of Ma'aseh Bereishis. So Gehenim is created on the second day, so in that sense it can be said to precede the world, even if it wasn't before the beginning of Ma'aseh Bereishis. Anyway, the point is that Tofseh was saying there's a name of Gehenim. Rashi points out, though, the rest of the pasuk continues after it says, Ki Oruch Me'esmul Tofseh, the end of that same pasuk continues, Midurosa Eish Ve'etzim Harbe, its bonfire has lots of fire and lots of wood, which therefore is referring to Gehenim. So we see another name of Gehenim is Tofseh. Why didn't we count that among the seven before? And the answer is, again, that's not a real name of Gehenim. Hahu Shekolam is Spata V'Yitzrei Nofel Sham. That refers to, it means anybody who is seduced by his Yetzer Hara into doing Averis falls in over there. So in other words, again, it's not a specific thing that a person does wrong. Both this and Gehenim were saying are more general things. In general, a person doesn't behave properly, then he winds up over there. The other seven that we said are specific things that are specific midas that a person might have that cause him to get to one level or another. Here, these two names are more generic names for the concept of Gehenim altogether. Tosfos, by the way, brings up another point. There's a pasuk in Mishlei at the Perek Lamed of Mishlei is a collection of statements. It begins over there, Divrei Ogur Bin Yoke, and then Medrash says with that, that's another nickname of Shlomo HaMelech himself. And then in the middle of the Perek, you have a pasuk that begins, La Aluka Shtei Bonis Hab. The Aluka, which most of the Mephoshim there explains, means a leech, has two daughters, and they're always yelling out, give, give. So there are Midrashim that explain that Aluka means Gehenim, because it's always looking for new victims. So like a leech, which is always sucking blood, it's always asking, give, give more. So in that case, Aluka is another name of Gehenim. So why isn't it listed over here? So Tosfos gives an interesting possibility. Rabbi Natam says, Aluka over there is not actually a name of Gehenim, and it doesn't mean a leech. It's rather the name of the Chacham who said this teaching that's in the Pasuk over there. In other words, he would translate the Pasuk, La Aluka, the following teaching comes from Aluka. He says, Shtei Bonis, have, there are two daughters who are saying, give, give. And the Pasuk goes on to describe metaphorically what they are. And then Tosfos points out there are midrashim that don't fit with that, and in fact there's a piyut, one of the piyutim from Rabbi Elazar HaKaller refers to Gehenim as Elech, which is the same shodesh as Aluka. So it seems there is definitely grounds to say that Aluka is a name of Gehenim, and in that case you'd have to wonder why it's not listed over here in the Gemara. Next, now that we talked about Gehenim, let's talk about Gan Eden. So Gan Eden, Omer Shlokish. Now, before we said that Gehenim has three openings, Gan Eden, Bepashtos, has only one. So therefore, so where is that opening located? Omer Shlokish, in the Eretz Yisrael, who, if Gan Eden is located in Eretz Yisrael, Beis Sha'an Pischa, then the entrance of it must be at Beis Sha'an. Beis Sha'an is an area, it's in the north of Eretz Yisrael, near the Yarden. It's an extremely fertile area. It's one of the areas of the best farmland in Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, such delicious and luscious fruits grow over there that Rish Lakish is saying that kind of place would be the ideal entrance to Gan Eden. If that's only the entrance, if the fruit over there is so delicious and that's only the entrance to Gan Eden, imagine what it's like in Gan Eden itself. Moshe points out that now you have in the Psukim, you don't really have anything in, but when it comes to Gehenim, we brought Psukim before that demonstrate that it has multiple openings. Gan Eden, we really never find that, which is why the Gemara is assuming that it has only one opening. However, Moshe says that we did learn in Masechta Shabbos, we talked about Sha'arei Gan Eden, the gates of Gan Eden, so that might imply that there are in fact multiple openings, unless we say, of course, there's just one opening with two gates. So again, the idea is, since Gan Eden, we know the fruit of it is very delectable, then therefore we're understanding over here that it means that these places that Rish Lakish is mentioning are all potential openings of Gan Eden. Marsha, by the way, mentions another point as well. You have the famous Gemara in Sanhedrin, where Rabbi Shurban Levi goes and meets Mashiach, and Eliyahu HaNavi tells him, you'll find him by Pischa Deroimi. You'll find him by the gate Deroimi. Now, what does Jeroimi mean? It can mean the south. It can mean on the south. So in that case, that would indicate, says Marashah, that Gan Eden has an entrance in different directions, one of them being towards the south. On the other hand, Rashi over there explains it means Jeroimi of Rome. And there are other Rishonim who learn that way as well. That means that it means he's sitting by the gates of Rome. That Amban, for example, in his famous Vikuach, he mentions that the Galochim over there asked him about that, and he explains to them basically it's an Agadah and he can't really understand it, but he brings over there afterwards in the transcript that he wrote and circulated among the Jewish community, he says there's actually Midrashim that implied that he's going to stay there until he finally destroys Rome. Anyway, so Maharsha says, on the face of it though, where is Mashiach? It's not in Gan Eden. What is Gan Eden doing having an entrance in Rome, where we're talking about over here, about Eretz Yisrael and Arabia and whatever, and we don't really find that it has one over there. So therefore, Maharsha says it works out better if you basically on our Gemara, if you say that Pischa Deroimi means the southern entrance of Gan Eden. Anyway, so if it's in Eretz Yisrael, then the opening to it must be in Beis Sha'an. The Imba Arviyahu, if it's in Arabia, Beis Grom Pischa, then the entrance of it must be in Beis Grom, which was also an area over there that was particularly fertile. The im ben hanahorisu, and if it's between the rivers, meaning in Syria, Damascus Pisra, then its entrance must be in Damascus, which is also a very fertile area in the middle of the Syrian desert over there. What about the Bavel? In suppose that there's an entrance to get to Gan Eden in Bavel, where would it be located? Abaya mishtabach peri de Ava Yamina. So Abaya used to praise the fruit of Ava Yamina, meaning the right bank or the south bank of the Cross River. And the Gemara in other places mentions that it was a very desolate area. The Gemara we learned in Brachas, for example, that one time one of the Chachamim was walking over there and was attacked by a lion, as the place is mentioned in one or two other places in Chas. But in a case, the fruit of it was very high quality, and Abaya used to praise that. So in other words, the idea being, if there's an entrance to Gan Eden in Bogo, then that would be a place for it to be located. Rava mishtabach bepeder de Harpania, and Rava rather would praise the fruit of Harpania, which is another town someplace in Bavel where also the fruit there was very high quality. We find that I haven't seen anybody explain particularly why the Gemara needs to mention this point about Ava Yamina and Harpania, but we're saying Ava Yamina was a very desolate area. Harpania, there's a Gemara in Yevamos that mentions that the people from there were not miyuchosim. There's a suspicion that they were actually descended from Avdei Shloima, from Shloima Melech's slaves who were brought in Golus to Babel, and they settled over there. So maybe the Gemara wants to inform us that even though these places have these problems, they're one of them is wild and desolate and full of wild animals, and the other one is full of people who are lacking Yichus, nevertheless, they have something good going for them, namely their fruit. And then and they might even be an entrance to Gan Eden because of that. Okay. Further on, a couple of blocks later, the Gemara is discussing various dinim as far as Erevin and Pasei Berois and so forth. So then the Gemara all of a sudden brings in some Agadah. I didn't really see clearly what the connection is between it and the previous Gemara. I think maybe just that it mentioned this Amorah Mori Bar Mar, so therefore now the Gemara brings another teaching from it. So Amar of Chista, Dorash Mori Bar Mar, my dichtiv, the Pasuk says in Tillim, L'chol Tichlo Re'isi Kates, to all tichla, meaning all things that a person might desire, I found an end. Rechava mitzvah chamoed, your mitzvah is very wide. So there's no limit to the Torah, unlike there's a limit to all other pleasures. Still, the implication is rechava mitzvah chamoed. It's very wide, but implying there is a certain defined size there. So what is the size of the Torah? Now, the Alter Rebbe points out in Tanya a different explanation of it. He says mitzvah over there refers to tzedakah, and rechava mitzvah chamoed means that it's a very wide keli to receive a lot of brachas from Hashem, unlike most other mitzvahs which are limited in their scope. But here, the Gemara is understanding that rechava mitzvah chamoed refers to the Torah in general, so therefore there's something about the Torah that can be described as very wide. Well, how wide is it? So David HaMelech explained, it said this, positive, until him, but he didn't explain what it means. Eov also says something in this connection, and he also doesn't clearly explain it. Then Yechezkel says a relevant pasuk about it, and still doesn't fully explain it. Until Zechariah ben Ido, the Navi, one of the last Nevi'im, Chagas Zechariah Malachi. So he finally explained what the actual size of the Torah is relative to the world. So what is it? Let's start with David. Omer David leipirshay dichtiv v'chol tichlo re'itzi keitz. Remember, Omer Eov leipirshay dichtiv. Eov says it's actually not Eov himself that's saying this pasuk. It's actually one of his friends. So for Hanamasi, but maybe the Gemara is assuming that since Eov maybe Eov eventually wrote down, maybe Eov later on wrote down a transcript of what was discussed in these discussions, and therefore the Gemara attributes it to him. Anyway. So he says, the Torah, the Chochmah of Torah, is longer than the earth and wider than the sea. So okay, we know it's larger than the world, but how much larger, he doesn't specify. Then comes Yechezkel and explains it further, but he still doesn't explain it completely. He describes over there how as Uri in his Nebuah, Hashem shows him a scroll, and he tells him. And Hashem tells him we have the famous pasuk that's written on the that you write on the egg when you're doing Achnas al-Cheder. You have the pasuk over there that Hashem tells him that you should, so to speak, eat this Megillah, meaning absorb the message of it, and then go be a Navi and tell the Jewish people what they need to be told. So he describes by Yifros Oisalafonai. He says. He spread out the scroll in front of me, which Rashi explains specifically. This is a scroll of Torah Shabbat Peh. Torah Shabbat Sav, when you get down to it, is not that large. We can't really describe it as being larger than the world, like the way Eeyore did. So therefore, we have to understand, says Rashi, that we're talking about a scroll containing Torah Shabbat Peh. So he says, Hashem spread it out, the Malach spread it out in front of me. V'hi chsuv aponim v'ocher, it was written on the back and on the front, and it was written in it, kinim and hege and he. So the simple meaning is that kinim, hege, and he are all expressions of woe. Kinim is like kinos, hege is a loshen meaning sounds like moaning sounds, and he is meloshen hoi, meloshen woe. So Mefarshim on the pasuk explains, in other words, it means in the simple meaning of the pasuk, it means that Hashem is showing Yechezkel what he's going to be telling the Jewish people, all these nevuos of disaster if they don't do tshuva, and therefore he's described as being shown this Megillah full of woe and lamentations and all that he's going to have to tell the Jewish people. But here the Gemara is understanding that it means something a little bit different. Kinim elu puronusam shal tzaddikim ba'olam hazeh. The word kinim refers to the punishments and the sufferings that tzaddikim undergo in this world. V'cheinu omer kino hi v'koninu avagomer. As we find the word kina referring to punishment, we find Yechezkel in his nevuah that we were talking about before about all the goyim who are going to be killed in Mochamas Gog Magog. So he describes it kina here as a lamentation for the disaster that's going to befall them. V'koninu and you should bewail it. So we see that kinim refers to punishment. Next, Barhege, the second word in the pasuk Barhege, Rashi explains the lashon of Simcha. So Zumat and Schorim, so Tzaddikim, Lasim Lavoi, this means that Hashem was showing Yechezkel the schar of the Tzaddikim will be getting Lasim Lavoi. L'cheinu Omer, Alei Osir, Alei Novel, Aleihi Goyin B'chino. As we find that David is singing to Hashem in Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbos and saying on a ten-stringed harp and on a nevel with He Goyin, with the harp, with the violin, so we see that Higoyed is a Lashon of Simcha. So Hege is a Lashon of Simcha. Vahi, and the last word in the Vahi, Zu Poranusim Shoroshoyim Lasid Lavoi, this refers to the punishment that the Rishoyim are going to be, that's going to come on the Rishoyim Lasid Lavoi. Vachain Hoima, Hoival, Hoivachavav again, as Yechezkel himself uses the expression, destruction will come upon destruction. So we see that he is related to the word Hoiva. So therefore, see, Yechezkel is telling us a detail that we didn't have before, which is that the Megillah of Torah Shabbat Peh is written on the back and on the front. Whereas in David HaMelech's description and in Eeyore's description, we don't have that detail. Ad Shabbat Zechariah ben Iddo, your Pirshoi, then finally Zechariah ben Iddo, at the beginning of the second Mishnah, comes and fully explains it. Dichtiv, he also sees a scroll, he sees a Vayomer Elai Moata Roya, so the Malach who's speaking to, you know, to Zechariah asks him, what do you see? But Omar, and I said, Ani Roya Megillah Ofa, I see a Megillah offer. Now, before Shimon, the pasuk understand offer, the Meloshin oif, Meloshin that it's flying. But the Gemara is understanding offer as meaning fold. The Aramaic word if or off means to fold. So therefore, he says a folded Megillah. Orka esrim ba'ama v'roch ba'esa ba'ama. The length of it is 20 amas and the width of it is 10 amas. So 20 by 10, that's when it's folded. So if you unfold it, we assume it's folded in half, then how much does it become law? Esrim to esrim, then it's 20 by 20. Now Yechezkel had described what we assume is the same Megillah, that it was written on the front and the back. So that means the total writing area was, you have 20 by 20 on one side, which is 400 square amas, and the same thing on the back, so you have a total of 800 square amas. V'chi kalfas la. Now, if you were to peel those two sides apart, so that you have like this, you would have to turn it over to see the other side. But if instead you don't, if you split it in its thickness, so now you can take the two written sides and put them one next to the other. Kama habula. How much do you have now? Arboin v'esrin. Now you have an area 40 by 20 amas, 800 square amas. Now, we're talking Hashem's amas. Uchtiv, you have a pasuk in Yeshaya. Mi modad b'shalei mayim. who is it that measured out the water in the hollow of his hand? The Shemayim, Bazeres Tikin, and he set up the heavens with his Zeres. So Rashi explains, that means, in other words, so the Shemayim is above the Oretz, Kimei HaShemayim al Oretz. So therefore, so if the heavens are measured with Hashem's Zeres, and a Zeres is a half Amma, then it means the size of the whole world, in terms of Hashem's Ammas, is a half an Amma. So therefore, is there a half an Amma by a half an Amma, which would be a quarter of it, which would be a quarter of a square Amma. If we said that the Megillah of Torah Shavah Peh, the written area, is 800 square Amos of Hashem's, then that means you're talking, so 800 divided by one quarter equals 3,200. Nimsa kol olam kula echad mishloisha salafin o masayim batorah. So it comes out that the entire world is only 1/3,200th part of the Torah. So now we understand when David says, Rechava mitzvah schma'od, your Torah is very wide, and when Eov says, then we know, it means now we know, based on what Zechariah is explaining, that it's 3,200 times the size of the world. So what's going on over here? So first of all, I mean, Ion Yaakov points out one thing, is we see from that, a Chacham should never give up trying to understand the Torah. You see over here that David and Eov and Yechezkel couldn't fully explain it, but it was left for Zechariah to fully explain this detail that they didn't. But Maharsha explains in some detail. We know there's four different ways of learning Torah. Pshat Rem is Drush inside. So therefore, corresponding to that is why you have the Torah written on the front and the back and folded over, representing that you have four different parts. So now you have like this. Pshat and Drash are relevant to Nigla of Torah. So they're included together in the sense when David HaMelech says, Rechava mitzvah chama'od, and Eov says, Aruka me'eretz midor, Rechava mini'yam, they're referring right away to the measurements of the Nigla aspect of Torah. Those we need to know right off the bat. So therefore, though, they have to talk about it first. Actually, within that, David HaMelech mentions only the width, which is relevant to mitzvahs, and Eov mentions the Torah, so therefore he's mentioning the length of it as well. So that covers Pshat and Drush. Then you have Yechezkel, there is the first one to describe that it's written on the front and the back, the front representing Nigla and the back representing Nister. And he's explaining that it refers to the troubles that the tzaddikim have and the reward that they get in the future and the punishment that the rishonim are going to get in the future. So all of this we darshin from sukkim. None of this is really explicit in Torah Shabbat. All of this is only in Torah Shabbat. So Yechezkel, who's the first one to tell us that there's a backside of the Megillah as well, representing the rest of Torah Shabbat, he's the one who talks about kinim v'hegavahi. Then Zechariah sees all four parts. So first he sees it folded, representing, he sees only the pshat part. Then you unfold it, and then you take two sides and put them one to the other, and therefore you have, now you have everything. You have Nigla and Nister. You have Maisa Bereshis and Maisa Merkava. So now you put everything together, and now you have the full dimension of Torah Shabbat Peh. So that's why that's represented by the point that you have the four sides all placed one next to the other. Why Dafka 3,200? I didn't really see anybody explaining it clearly, but we do know there's Lamed Beis Nesivas Chochma. There's in Sefer Yetzirah at the beginning. It talks about there's 32 paths of the Chochma of Hashem, representing the 22 letters of the Aleph Beis and the 10 Sefiros. And each one of them, 100, represents something that we talk about in Sidus, that you have 10 is the 10 spheres and Eser Kol Me'eser, so therefore you have 100, and it represents a more transcending, where it represents Sovev or whatever, so therefore 3,200 may be the Gemara means that the Torah is like that, it's Sovev is Sovev on the world with all the Lamed Beis and Sivas Chochma. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Gola. Zion Tammuz. So we started talking about yesterday that Abba had started quoting in Torah, in Kundras Torah Hadashim Iti Teitze. So you have, there's the Chiddush Torah, there's the type of Chiddush Torah that can't even be revealed by Talmud Vosik, who learns upon the quality of Torah. We know that even a Talmud Vosik, whatever he comes up with, was already given to Moshe Sinai, but sometimes you have there's such a level of Chiddush of Torah that can't even be revealed by such a Talmud Vosik, only by Hashem himself. And yet, Melech HaMashiach, who, as we quoted yesterday from the Rambam, is going to be Baal Chochma, Yosef Shlomo, or be even wiser than Shlomo, he will be able to explain those deep secrets of Torah, that Chiddush Torah, in the base of Nagodol Shebi Yerushalayim, in a way that they will be able to understand it with their seichel according to the rules of Torah. So that's the point, in other words, that this great, tremendous gilui is going to be brought down in a way that can be absorbed even into their seichel. Continuing on with halachas, so we're talking about the halachas of not doing business with non-kosher things. So we were talking about if you have something that's also midaraisa to eat, then you're not allowed to do a regular business with it, but if you happen to get a hold of such a thing, then you're allowed to sell it in order not to have a loss. If it's only also midarabanan, then you're allowed to make a regular business selling it. An example he gives is cheese made by goyim. Midaraisa would be mutter, the Gemara tells us in Avodah Zarah, because the milk of non-kosher animals won't form cheese. The curds of it are too small to form cheese. Midrabanan, it's also for a number of different reasons that it mentions in the Gemara Avodah Zarah. So therefore, the point is, it's only also midrabanan, so therefore you'd be allowed to make a business of selling goyish cheese.